Good morning and welcome. This is the last sermon and chapter in Leviticus. This is the 18th sermon, and to be honest, I thought I would do five or six, doing highlights of this book. But as I studied and God was teaching me, I realized I needed to go through the whole of Leviticus. So this last chapter seemed, the last chapter, chapter 26, seemed to be a good ending to the book. And after 25 chapters of commands, statutes, and rules, God told Israel that if they followed his rules, he would bless them. And if they did not follow his rules, he would judge them or curse them. Yet, even so, he would provide a way for them to turn back to him. God's grace and mercy is far greater than our sins. And as the song goes, our sins, they are many, his mercy is more. And verse 46 of chapter 26 says, "These are the statutes, rules, and laws that the Lord made between himself and the people of Israel through Moses on Mount Sinai." So that sounds complete. That sounds like a great ending to the book. Yet we have one more chapter. Why is that? But when you think about it, all the laws and the rules that God gave Israel, God promised to do something for them after they offered sacrifices and followed the rules and guidelines. God promised he would forgive their sins. He promised to bless their fields and livestock. He promised to protect them. He promised to be in their midst. He promised to lead them out of Egypt, which he did, and into Canaan, which he would. He promised to honor his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But this chapter, it's all about the people honoring their promises to God. What if they make a solemn vow to the Lord? So what is a vow? Well, a vow is simply a pledge, a promise that a person makes. In the U.S., we learned the Pledge of Allegiance to the U.S. flag. We say vows at weddings, which are promises to each other. There are monastic vows, and when I was ordained, I vowed to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and to stay true to the Word of God. Now, there have been many quote-unquote foxhole vows or promises during a time of war. Men who pray and tell God that if he brings them out of the battle alive, he will give his life to God. Those are in the heat of the moment vows with no thinking about the seriousness and integrity of the vow. But this book ends with vows, because all of Leviticus has concerned the promises of God to his people. And now this chapter is about whether they will live up to the promises that they have sworn to God. And since God is faithful in all instances to his vows, to his promises, then how are we doing in fulfilling our promises to God? As we look at this chapter, it's divided into three main sections. Verses 1 to 8, about a promised life. Verses 9 to 25, promised possessions. And the last few verses, promises of integrity. Plus, then we will look at the end of all this, what this means for us today. So we're basically going to look at what does it say, what did it mean to Israel, and what does it mean to us today. So I'm not going to read every verse again, but I will read several verses as we go along. And I'll start out by reading the first three verses of chapter 27. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, if anyone makes a special vow to the Lord involving the valuation of persons, then the valuation of a male from 20 years old up to 60 years old shall be 50 shekels of silver according to the shekel of the sanctuary." And then it goes on and it gives different amounts depending on the ages and the genders. Now, while very few of those foxhole vows were ever fulfilled by the soldiers, there is the example of a woman in a dire situation who was in her own sort of foxhole in the heat of the moment situation, and she vowed a vow to the Lord, asking that he give her a son, and she would then dedicate her son to the service of the Lord. Think about that. A woman who is childless during biblical times, so, and this would be for her, this would be about 4,000 years ago, childless during biblical times, so she was despised by women, by other women. All she ever wanted was a child to say that she did her part in fulfilling the covenant that God had made with Abraham, that he would be fruitful and his family would multiply and be more than the stars in the heaven and the sands and the seashore. All she wanted was to be fruitful and have a son. So if so, if God would do that, then she would give the son back to God. Her heart's desire was a son, and she would give the son back to God, dedicated to God, to service to the Lord. That's a vow few of us would want to commit to. Yet that is the commitment that Hannah made with God in 1 Samuel 1, verses 10 and 11, and then verses 24 to 28. So first off, let me read verses 10 and 11. She was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but will give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. Hannah had been mocked by her husband's second wife, who had several children. The other women, they mocked the other woman. She mocked her, excuse me, her barren state, causing Hannah great distress. That was her spiritual state, Hannah's spiritual state, when she was praying and pleading for the Lord to hear her prayers and accept her vow. God heard her prayer, and he accepted her vow, and he granted her a son. So her husband then went to the temple for their yearly sacrifices, because he was a godly man, and he was following the traditions that the commandments and the rules and the statutes that God had laid out, as we have learned in Leviticus. So he was going for the yearly sacrifices, and he also went to pay the vow, as is mentioned in our text in verse 6. So verse 6 explains that a male under 5 years of age was worth 5 shekels. So he went to pay the vow price to the sanctuary, to the temple. After Hannah weaned her son, Samuel, she then took him to the temple to dedicate his life to the service of the Lord. So at this time, he's about 4 or 5 years old, maybe. Old enough for to eat and drink on his own, and didn't need his mother's protection and care for the first few years of life. And so we don't know exactly how old Samuel was when he was brought to the temple. But in verses 24 to 28, it says, and when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, a skin of wine, and she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And the child was young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who is standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me what I asked of him. So now I give him to the Lord. For his whole life he will be given over to the Lord. See, I'm taking time to share this story because it's a prime example of the seriousness of the vow laws here in chapter 27. Plus, it ties into the sacrifices that were required for vows in Leviticus 7, in chapter 7. They were to pay the temple vow price, plus bring the sacrifices for a vow. The sacrifices were part of dedicating and committing the life of the son to serve the Lord within the temple. This was a commitment. Hannah did not make a rash foxhole decision. She had lived in her barren state her whole life, and God was the only one who could change that, and she vowed to commit her son to the Lord, if only she could have a son. Now, before we move on, there is a detail about her vow that requires a closer look, because it's also connected with chapter 27 here. She said that she vowed that no razor would touch his head. Now, that may seem an odd detail, but it is actually a type of vow that is described in Numbers 6. In Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Numbers is one of the books of the Torah, of the laws of Moses. And so it's the fourth book of the Bible. In Numbers chapter 6, it explains what a Nazirite vow is. A Nazirite vow could be a lifelong commitment or a set amount of time. There's actually only three people who was a lifelong commitment. In all other instances, it's voluntary. But it was not voluntary for Samson, Samuel, and John the Baptist. They were from birth to live a life as a Nazirite. So, to live the Nazirite vow. Now, the main points of a Nazirite vow are that the person would not drink wine or anything to do with a grape, anything fermented, any strong alcohol or anything to do with a grape, never cut their hair, and never touch a dead body, human or animal. They were to be holy to the Lord. If someone said they were dedicating the next 3 years, like this was a voluntary thing, to serve the Lord, and they took a Nazirite vow, then for those 3 years, they were committed to honor their vow. Depending on their age and gender, they would need to pay the appropriate amount and keep their part of the promise with the Lord. Their vow is not with a man. These vows here in chapter 27 and this Nazirite vow, these are not a vow between a man and a man. These vows are always with the Lord. Every vow law in Leviticus 27 is between the person, man or woman, and God. It is not with any other man but God alone. Now, twice in the book of Acts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in Acts, Acts of the Apostles, twice in Acts, in chapter 18, verse 18, and chapter 21, verses 23 to 26, Paul was mentioned with Nazirite vows. In chapter 18, verse 18, it was Paul who had completed a vow. It says, after this, Paul stayed many days longer and then took leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria, and with him Priscilla and Aquila. And at Cenchrea, he had cut his hair, for he was under a vow. So he had completed his Nazirite vow, the time of service that he had committed to. We don't know how long that was. Could have been a few months, could have been a couple of years, we don't know. But he had cut his hair because he was under a vow. He had just completed. And in chapter 21 of Acts, Paul was with four other men who were under the Nazirite vow. And it says, do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses. That's the expense of the vow. Whatever age they were and the cost. According to that, that's what their expense was that they had to pay to the sanctuary, to the temple. Pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. So they may cut their heads. Thus, cut their hair. Thus, all who know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but that you yourselves also live in observance of the law. So then Paul took the men, and the next day he purified himself, along with them, so that way he was ritually clean as they were, and he went into the temple and giving notice when the days of purification would be fulfilled and the offering presented for each one of them. It wasn't just one offering, whatever that was, a bull or a lamb or a goat or whatever. Whatever the sacrifice was, it was per person. See, this example shows that they paid the vow price to the temple and they brought the required sacrifices for each one. Paul was fulfilling what the psalmist wrote in Psalm 56. I must perform my vows to you, O God. I will render thank offerings to you. See, the vows were honored, and the sacrifices and offerings were brought to the temple in honor of the Lord's command. Now, the next section is about the dedication of animals and land to the Lord. And I'm going to read verses 9 to 15. If he vowed an animal that is acceptable as an offering to God, the animal is given to God and becomes the property of the sanctuary. He must not exchange or substitute a good one for a bad one, or a bad one for a good one. If he should dishonestly substitute one animal for another, both the original and the substitute become property of the sanctuary. If what he vowed is a ritually unclean animal, one that is not acceptable as an offering to God, the animal must be shown to the priest, who will set its value either high or low. Whatever the priest sets will be its value. If the owner changes his mind and wants to redeem it, he must add 20% to its value. If a man dedicates his house to God into the possession of the sanctuary, the priest assesses its value, setting it high, either high or low. Whatever value the priest sets, that's what it is. If the man wants to buy it back, he must add 20% to its price, and then it's his again. So the main focus of this section is animals for sacrifice and land dedicated to the Lord, land or a house. So let's look at the animals first. You know, we spent a couple of weeks at the beginning of Leviticus, so it'd be several weeks ago, a couple of months ago. We spent a couple of weeks looking at the descriptions of the sacrifices in chapters 1 through 7 and the animals that were required for those sacrifices. In Leviticus 22, God reminded Moses and Aaron about the purity of the animals that were offered for sacrifices. God said, "Don't try slipping in some creature that has a defect. It won't be accepted. Whenever anyone brings an offering from cattle or sheep as a peace offering to God to fulfill a vow or as a free will offering, it has to be perfect, without defect, to be acceptable. Don't try giving God an animal that is blind, crippled, mutilated, an animal with running sores, a rash, or mange. Don't place any of these on the altar as a gift to God." See, when Israel was bringing a sacrifice to the Lord, they were promising to the Lord that they were giving him the best. In our verses 9 to 13, God was telling them what the cost would be to correct their error if they did not give their best. If they knew that they were being dishonest in presenting their offerings to the Lord, it was going to cost them. They were either going to lose both animals, the good and the bad offering, or they were going to have to pay an extra 20% of the value of the rejected animal to correct things. The animals offered to the Lord were to be holy. They were to be as God commanded. Let's say, what if Patrick here was buying beef cattle and your man tried to pass off the dairy cows as beef? I'm sure Patrick here would not accept the wrong animals, and the man's deception would be found out. How many other people has this man deceived? See, deceiving a man is one thing, but deceiving God is a whole different story. God is never deceived. God is never tricked or caught unaware. The second section here concerns a man dedicating his home or his land to the Lord. Verses 14 and 15 is all about the home, the man's house. Maybe he wants to give the house to be used for the Lord as housing for the priests for, let's say, 3 years. If the man wants the house back, then he must pay 20% more to redeem the house to himself. Otherwise, it is a holy gift to the Lord. And I know of a couple who have allowed their house to be used for several years while they were missionaries in China. They still owned the house, but the church managed the house as a guest house for people traveling through the area and needed a place to stay. That's a modern day example of this. Now, in verses 16 to 25 is about dedicating land to the Lord and the cost for redeeming the land if the person wanted it back. Again, these are gifts to the Lord, whether it was forever or for a certain amount of time. And the dedication of such costly item showed the enthusiasm that a person had for the worship and ministry of the temple. Making and faithfully keeping one's vows was a sign of a person's spiritual condition, spiritual maturity. Vows were considered holy gifts to the Lord that were to be given out of a holy motivation, a holy purpose. This was not for personal gain or public recognition, but was due to that person's relationship with the Lord. The psalmist sang in Psalm 61:8, "So I will ever sing praises to your name as I perform my vows day after day." Only a person with integrity and desiring to live a holy life for the Lord would enter into solemn vows with the Lord. And that brings us to talking about integrity. And then I'll read the rest of the chapter, starting at verse 26. No one is allowed to dedicate the firstborn of an animal. The firstborn, as firstborn, already belongs to God. No matter if it's cattle or sheep, it already belongs to God. If it's one of the ritually unclean animals, he can buy it back as its assessed value by adding 20% to it. And if he doesn't redeem it, then it is to be sold at its assessed value. But nothing that a man irrevocably devotes to God from what belongs to him, whether human or animal or family land, may be either sold or bought back. Everything devoted is holy to the highest degree. It's God's inalienable property. No human who has been devoted to destruction can be redeemed. He must be put to death. A tenth of the land's produce, whether grain from the ground or fruit from the trees, is God's. It is holy to God. If a man buys back any of the tenth he has given, he must add 20% to it. A tenth of the entire herd and flock, every tenth animal that passes under the shepherd's rod is holy to God. He is not permitted to pick out the good from the bad or make a substitution. If he dishonestly makes a substitution, both animals, the original and the substitute, become the possession of the sanctuary and cannot be redeemed. These are the commandments that God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai for the people of Israel. So when you think about it, everything and everyone is the Lord's. He has claim on everything and everyone and everyone because he created all things. In these last few verses, God was stating that these things and these people, he's saying, these are dedicated to me. In verses 26 and 27, God stated that all firstborn of animals are dedicated to him. They're already his. They are to be used for sacrifices or given to the temple. An unclean animal, such as a camel, may be redeemed plus 20% added. The temple either gets the unclean animal to resell to someone else, or the owner can give the purchase price to the temple and keep the camel. In verse 28, God said that anything devoted to him is not redeemable. If someone gives a donation and says that this is a gift to the temple to be used for the Lord's work, then it is holy to the Lord and is only for the Lord. The word for devoted is herem, H-E-R-E-M, which means devoted to God, not redeemable. If someone gave the temple a donkey and cart and said, "I am giving this donkey and cart for the use of the Lord," then he cannot come back a month later and ask for it back. It's not redeemable. He has given it as a gift to the Lord. Verse 29 is simply, if a man has committed a crime that has the death penalty, has the punishment of death, nothing can change the verdict. There is no ransom to be paid to free him. And then the last few verses are about giving a tithe to the Lord. A tithe is 10% of his harvest and his herds and flocks. Every tenth animal shall be given to the Lord, and there is no substitute. You can't say that God gets the worst of the field and the flock. If he gave God the best of his sheep, then tried to substitute a lame sheep for the healthy one, he loses both. God takes both, and there is no chance to redeem either one. The reason is to stop man from trying to deceive God, which can't happen anyways. This also means that if a person has vowed to give animals to the Lord, those animals are not substitutes for the tithe. The vow offering of animals, the gift of these animals, is above and beyond the tithe to the Lord. All right, so we've gone through all this, and as I've mentioned in most of the sermons of Leviticus, the laws in these books, in this book, were written for Israel at a certain time. They were written for a specific people, Israel, at a specific time. God was showing them how to worship him, what needed to be done for forgiveness of sin, how to live holy lives while surrounded by an unholy world. God restated several times throughout Leviticus the different Ten Commandments. And those laws are timeless. Moral laws then are moral laws now. And those we still follow, the Ten Commandments, those moral laws. We still follow, but we do not need to follow the sacrificial system or any of the laws that connect back to those offerings and rituals. The vows listed in this last chapter, including the costs to pay to the temple, are not needed to be followed. Yet, there are principles that are the foundations of these laws that we can still learn from. And two main principles I'm just going to mention are integrity and giving to the church. Now, first, there is the integrity that comes with making a promise to someone, and especially to God. Your wedding vows are broken about 50% of the time. And when people break that vow, are they thinking it's only with the other person? Because the marriage vow is between three people, husband, wife, and God. The vows are made before God, yet this seems to be forgotten. Solemn vows before God should never be taken lightly. There are too many men who are ordained to preach the gospel, yet after a few years of ministry and facing some difficult situations or feeling that no one in the church is listening and no one cares, they decide to leave the ministry. They are giving up on God's calling in their life. So where is our integrity when we give up? Let me just read a few verses. Psalm 7, verse 8. The Lord judges the peoples. Judge me, O Lord, according to my righteousness and according to the integrity that is in me. And in Psalm 26:11, but as for me, I shall walk in my integrity. Redeem me and be gracious to me. And Proverbs has much to say about a man's integrity. Whoever walks in integrity walks securely, but he who makes his ways crooked will be found out. The integrity of the upright guides them, but the crookedness of the treacherous destroys them. And Jesus even taught to not keep promises that you can't keep. Don't make promises that you can't keep. Let what you say simply be yes or no. Don't make a promise about something that you can't keep. Don't make a vow when you know you're going to break it anyways. The other idea is, besides integrity, is giving to the church. The writer of Hebrews said in chapter 13, verse 16, do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. Giving to the church should be liberally. Giving giving generously, faithfully, not just a one-time deal, but that it's just a way of life, and proportionally. You're not giving, you're giving, you're not giving out of, you're not putting yourself in debt. You know, somebody that's very wealthy can also give liberally, faithfully, and proportionally. But me, I can't give the same amount as the wealthy guy. So proportionally, I can't keep up with him, but proportionally, based on what God has provided with me, I can give liberally and faithfully. Giving to the Lord reflects the sacrificial giving of Christ. He emptied himself of his own heavenly glory to provide the riches of glory for us. We were impoverished in our sin. What we gain in material wealth, whatever that may be, was given to us by God so that we can give back to Him a portion, the tithe, as a sacrifice of praise. You know, Jesus was given the question as to who do we give to, God or Caesar? Jesus looked at a denarius, and it had Caesar's face on it, and He said, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and give to God what is God's." While we do not need to give as Israel gave to the temple for the various offerings, sacrifices, rituals, and vows, we are to give to support the work of the church, the outreach of the church, and the workers in the church. We are to give generously, joyfully, sacrificially, and proportionally. We're giving generously, we're giving joyfully because we want to give. Giving sacrificially, we're not thinking, okay, I'm just giving the bare minimum, whatever that minimum may be, and you're giving out of your own means. Our offerings are to the Lord and to His church. The gifts we bring to the work of the church, to the work of the church for the spreading of the gospel, those gifts are devoted to the Savior, to Jesus. It's not to the church leadership. Our giving to the church should be because we want to help the church reach out to the community, and we want to enthusiastically support the mission of the church. We are here today because a church in Antioch, 2,000 years ago, supported the first missionary journey of Paul and Barnabas to go out into the world and preach the gospel. We are here today because of one of those churches, Philippi, supported the missionary travels of Paul into Macedonia, where the gospel came to Europe for the first time. We're here today because individuals and churches supported missionaries to reach out to all areas of the world, preaching the gospel, planting churches, and making disciples so that the next generation of church leaders can keep them keep the momentum going until Christ returns. That's what it means to give to a church. It isn't for your glory. It isn't so that you feel good. If that's your motivation, then you need to have a heart-to-heart talk with God, with Jesus. You know, Jesus was in the temple with His disciples, and He was watching the parade of wealthy people walk by and dropping coins in the offering box, making sure that other people saw them walking by and heard how much money they were dropping in. And then He watched a poor widow give her two copper coins worth about a half a cent. And He said that the wealthy gave out of their abundance, but she gave all that she had. She was faithful in her giving, and she knew the Lord would provide for her needs. So in closing of this chapter and of the book of Leviticus, our giving and our integrity go hand in hand. All of Leviticus is about our living holy lives for the Lord while we live in an unholy world. Integrity in our vows and our promises includes our integrity in giving to the Lord. If we vow and promise to be to support the local church, then that includes giving to the Lord. That's all part of our living a holy life for the Lord. Let's pray.